Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping me, as always, on time and on target. And you are listening to the Engagement Hour. The Engagement Hour focuses on trying to get the great citizens of our country involved. Voting is one of the most sacred rights we have. And as I've said, to be an involved citizen, you need to be an informed voter. And that was very important, and that played out last week. There's a lot of ways to serve our country. You can serve our country in the military, in public safety, through being an educator and in education, through nonprofit work, and through volunteerism. There's just a lot of ways to do it. But Matt, I already told my guest I need to steal a few minutes at the front of the show, so we're going to do a pretty little quick because I've not been back on the air in this studio until about 15 minutes ago with Chris to talk about election results.
Wow, yeah.
And last week, my guest was Chuck Coughlin, and we discussed primaries.
The subject was especially how to improve voter turnout, I believe.
And we talked about the challenge of the nonpartisan folks. 209,000, this is an example we use, 209,000 independent, basically party not declared voters in Pima County. So out of 209,000 of them, how many of them do you think pulled a ballot?
I will guess 10%.
Oh, that would be 20,000 voters?
Yes.
No.
Wow. Not even that?
No.
Holy, wow. How many did?
According to Pima County's official results, the ballots cast by nonpartisan individuals.
Now, this includes independents and PNDs?
You know what? I'm going to say this wrong. So it's only 212 because that's too small. They cast party ballots or Democratic ballots. So I'm going to have to see if we can figure that out. And that's one of the challenges. We really don't know how many went. But if you look at it this way, the total number of ballots cast with over 6,000 or 628,000 voters. The final number was 197,000. So 31%. And you get down into the districts and you ward District 3, big race on the Democratic primary side. Again, just under 30% of the vote of the Democrats.
Gives us.
Now remember, we don't know if they were all Democrats. Some of those should be independents in theory. But the studies have shown us only about 10% to your number that you threw out there is what cast votes.
And that gives leverage, as you were saying, that gives a lot of leverage to certain groups.
It gives a ton. I think
it gives leverage to those who are engaged.
I think the biggest lesson we learned, there were so many people that were shocked. They were shocked at the number, the Conover-Jetty result. Two-thirds, one-third. I mean, there was a lot of, that was a very public campaign. It was in the paper. It was on the airways. It was vocal. They both were doing out there, and they both ran pretty solid campaigns. Yet the vote was two-thirds to one-third.
That was a stunner to me. That was, I think, the biggest stunner of the whole race,
of the whole election. But what we forget about the primaries is we don't get the 60 or the 80% turnout sometimes we approach in election years in off-presidential generals. And it's only the generals. In the primaries, we never get much more than 30%.
Yeah, to further diffuse the impact of the primary, the presidential preference is back in, what, February or March, right?
So absolutely.
That even diffuses that.
They don't need to show up for
that. Not that there was any sort of a vote on the Democratic ticket for that one, but you're right. I mean, that takes any energy away from the ballot that it might have had.
So the interesting thing to me is, what's that mean? What's the lesson learned? And the lesson learned is primaries are partisan events, and the voters that actually participate are the partisan members who are active and already engaged. So last Tuesday, I was telling everybody, get out, vote, take that right sacred, get engaged, vote. Well, it didn't, apparently my message isn't working very much, Matt, because we still ended up with just at 30% voter turnout. But the other thing I want to take a look at is we were talked a lot about the concept of open primaries. Make elections fair is going to be on the ballot. Is it perfect? No. Is it an improvement on our system? My argument would be yes. Why? Because we're going to get past 30% turnout. What would have happened in that county attorney's race? Two candidates, they both would have gone to the general, and then the entire population, when we've got a presidential ballot, probably going to get about 79%, somewhere between 75 and 80% of the voters will actually turn in a ballot. they all would have gotten to choose it. But instead, we saw immediately the editorial op-ed saying that this was a mandate. And I actually think the county attorney, Laura Conover, understands that it wasn't a mandate. It was that she wanted Democratic primary, because she's already said she wants to go out and listen and get feedback and hear more from the people who brought up some valid concerns of her first 4 years in office to improve at the public's perception of her job and role. So it's hard for people to claim that there's a mandate when we're talking about a result out of a primary. And if you look at it, if we had open primaries, that would have been different. Probably CD6 wouldn't have been much different. I think the results would have turned out. You would have probably had Kristen Engel coming in with the highest vote, but I still think Juan Ciscomani would have had more than Catherine Wynne, because I don't think Kathleen's campaign would have pulled over Democratic or independent voters. She was trying to win a Republican primary, as she should. That's the race she was in. She was in a Republican primary. But I think you still would have had the same two there. Now, the interesting one to me might have been that CD or that District 3. It would have on the Board of Supervisors, because it would have mattered how many of the independents who now don't have to pull a ballot, so you're going to get more than 10%. And how many of the Republicans might have come over to vote for a candidate like Edgar Soto and got him in the top two. Now, this is the argument the parties have. You could have two Democrats running the thing, but if everybody's allowed to vote and you get it that way, that's great. Do not forget, we had 16 Arizona State seats that were decided without a primary, and six of those, we already know who the senators are because there's no general. We had another 12 districts that had no primaries for the House. And now we have a total of 10 of those representatives we already know, because there is no general. And anytime there you say there's no general, like there's no general for the county attorney, that means over 70% of the population maybe never even had the opportunity to vote. So I think it's something we need to continue the conversation on going forward.
And, amen.
And that's my rant. We're going to go to break right now, but when I come back, I will have Misael Cabrera, your name anytime and make sure I get the pronunciation right. The director of the School of Mining and Mineral Resources at the University of Arizona. And we will have a discussion on his career, how he got involved, and what he sees for the future, both of the school and of mining in Arizona. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Yes, today will remain a heavy Springsteen day, I think. You know, coming out of that a little election rant we just had, I might need it. So I want to welcome Misael Cabrera to the show. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Ted.
And Misael Cabrera has been selected through a nationwide search as the inaugural director of the School of Mining and Mineral Resources. The school was created in 2021, and when we start talking about the programming and mining at the University of Arizona, you're going to find out that it's been around as part of the U of A for a lot longer than just since 2021, but it's currently jointly housed in the College of Engineering and the College of Sciences. I first got to know Mr. Cabrera when he was the director of the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, as we did a lot of work. I worked on some of the water boards with you. Obviously, we've talked about a lot of things there. And so that's going to be a big part of our conversation as well. But first, I always like to open this show, as you heard during the intro, is all about trying to get people engaged. So I want to hear a little bit from you, if you could, Ms. L, about your story of what brought you to Arizona. And then we'll get to how did you get involved in doing public service?
Certainly. So growing up, mom and dad moved around quite a bit. Mom and dad are from the island of Cuba. So those of us that have that background really appreciate the ability to be engaged in a meaningful way. There are a lot of countries all across the world where there's simply no opportunity for meaningful engagement. In the island of Cuba, for example, there's a single party. And so you're just voting on degrees of difference inside of a single party. And there's actually very little freedom and very little opportunity. And so those of us that have that background really have a heart and appreciation for voting, but also for engagement. And so I feel so grateful that we ended up in the United States. I was actually born on the island of Puerto Rico, which is a territory, so I got my citizenship for free, and I am really grateful for that. But growing up in the United States, one of the things that I noticed is that there's no limits to the opportunities that I could take advantage of. And no country's perfect, but we're as close to a meritocracy as you can get. And the best way to engage in that is through engagement. And so public service in particular. So in high school, I ended up in Arizona, went to Kofa High School in Yuma, Arizona, while we lived in Somerton, the town of about 10,000 people at the time.
Plenty warm there.
Yes. And it almost never rains, which is a little depressing if you happen to be from the Caribbean.
That is a true story. And I guess you don't have any of the mountains where the thunderstorms can build. They just pass you on by and keep it. When it does get a little more humid, it just gets muggy. It doesn't get rainfall for you.
That's correct. And so no one in my family had ever been to a university. In fact, we didn't even have family friends that had gone to a university.
What did your parents do, and how were they able to leave Cuba? I'm sorry, I know I'm taking you back a little bit, but to me that might be a fascinating thing for some of our listeners to hear.
Certainly. So mom and dad were vocational ministers and pastors. That's what they did.
In Cuba?
In Cuba. And so when Castro came in, he started really limiting freedom of religion. Mom and dad literally were blacklisted. So there was a literal list in the corner plaza that had their names on it as potential anti-revolutionaries. And the way they got out, oddly enough, is that dad had spent some time in New York going to a few years of seminary. He never completed it. But during that time with mom, they had my eldest brother, Felipe, and he was a U.S. citizen by birth. And so when they went back to Cuba, there was that anchor back to the U.S. that eventually allowed them to get out.
That's outstanding story, and I appreciate you sharing that, because that really, you know, you mentioned earlier there were so many opportunities, and, you know, you use the terminology take advantage of, and that's sometimes dangerous, because what you mean by it is there were so many opportunities that you had to pursue, because you've obviously created a very successful life for yourself in this country, but it didn't come free and it didn't come without any hard work. So I interrupted you when you were in Yuma. So where did you live there? And is that where you attended high school? Did I hear you say that?
That's correct. I graduated from Kofa High School. So, Kofa Kings. There's another high school in Yuma called Yuma High, and their mascot is the Criminals.
And there's a lot of people that are proud of that mascot.
I like to share with everyone that I'm not a criminal.
You're a king. You're a king.
And so I was fortunate that I had good counselors, good teachers. In particular, one of my art teachers, Walter Ashenfelter, literally drove me to the University of Arizona to attend an event once, and that's something I'll never forget, that kind of commitment and investment that Walt made in me. But I was fortunate to have a pathway to higher education. I studied civil engineering in particular, and during that time, environmental engineering was a very new field. It had just started at the University of Arizona, but the environmental field in terms of engineering was filled largely with chemical engineers and civil. So I took civil engineering, and then upon graduation, I started my career in a multinational engineering consulting firm doing environmental work.
Yeah, that to me was one of the things that jumped off at me at your background, is you went right into a consultant position, multinational and international, and that kind of, I think, may have given you some of the background of collaboration and working with others.
Absolutely. So in consulting, you always have a client, you always have a project, and you always have a limited budget. And with those constraints, teamwork is essential.
Oh, no, no doubt. No, you did say that you got your degree in civil engineering, but in the time, the field that you were looking at going into, both it was either civil engineer or environmental engineering. So did you ever go back and get some environmental experience? I know that's the answer. I'm just asking it to put him on the spot.
So in the civil engineering curriculum, there were environmental courses, but I also took some upper division courses at ASU. I took a couple while I was working, one on remediation and one on water treatment.
Well, there's no doubt those courses probably played a significant impact on the future and how you got into even more of what I call public service going down. But I want to go back and just highlight that the majority of the folks that I've had on this program and talked about how they got involved almost always have a connection to their family. That there was, and often it's not that the family was overly involved. Obviously, as pastors, or your parents were engaged in community involvement. But a lot of times, it's just somebody who sees what we have in this country and the need to get engaged and teaches their kids to do so. You know, I know that's Juan Siscomani's story. He was raised that way. And so I always love the fact that a lot of it comes back to the family. And appreciate you sharing that with us. So you worked in consulting. I know you did a couple other jobs with other companies, but what eventually got you into the public service domain and working in ADEQ?
So I got a call from the director at the time. His name was Henry Darwin. Henry and I knew each other in high school. We weren't close friends. We didn't hang out, but we knew each other in high school. We both went to COFA High School in Yuma, Arizona.
That's the point. And personal connections are important in all fields. And it's important for people to remember when you make those, everybody takes something away from you. So obviously here's somebody you went to high school with who you knew, and he led to an opportunity.
And while I was a consulting engineer working for CH2M Hill was the name of the company. It's now Jacobs. He and I had run into each other while he was growing up at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. So although we weren't close friends in high school, we ran into each other professionally when he was at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality and I was in consulting. And so when he became director, he was in need of a deputy. During that time, the administration really wanted to pivot the agency in terms of efficiency, productivity, mission orientation. And he had received the message to hire someone from the private sector to come in and help him because he had grown up in government. What happened was that Henry went through a long list of people, all of which said no. Some of which laughed at
him. You're telling me you were the last option he had?
So we have to remember this is on the heels of the Great Recession.
Absolutely.
So this is 2011 timeframe. He had just become interim director and then finally become director several months back and was in search of a deputy. The agency had lost 30% of their funding. Many agencies during the Great Recession suffered budget losses. With that came a reduction in force of about 30%. The agency at that time was not known for being professional, efficient, and effective. And so it wasn't really that attractive to a lot of the folks that were already in the private sector making a lot of money. But as I like to say, I'm a sucker for making a difference, which I learned from my parents, as you mentioned before. And so when Henry talked to me about the position, I asked him what his biggest problems were. And in that conversation, I saw that there was an opportunity for me to make a difference.
Well, I know your initial time as the deputy director was focused in on some leaning of the process. You brought in some of those, you know, back in that, the Six Sigma, the lean programmatics, all that stuff in. And that led to your next appointment. Because when Governor Doug Ducey took over, I believe fairly quickly, he named you as the director of ADEQ.
Yeah, so We invited Doug Ducey to come to ADQ. He saw what we were doing. He saw one of our team huddles, our performance metrics. Very shortly thereafter,
Business influence.
Very shortly thereafter, he promoted Henry Darwin to the governor's office, and then I was selected as director.
Well, that's outstanding. I always think that sometimes when the government gets too big, you need to bring in some of those business-minded folks to bring it back down and make it more efficient and effective. So when we come back, you'll hear more from Misael Cabrera, the director of the School of Mining and Mineral Resources. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk, and the Engagement Hour. We'll see you after the bottom of the hour break. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. This is the Engagement Hour. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, and Matt Neely's behind playing the Springsteen tracks, which always makes it difficult for me because my brother and I are currently trying to create our top 10 list of Springsteen songs. And there's just so many, Matt. I mean, just so many. What you know, so difficult.
Where do you start?
Yeah, I know where I start.
Good luck with that one.
Exactly. It's going to be a lot of fun. My guest today is Misael Cabrera. He's the director of the School of Mining and Mineral Resources at the University of Arizona. We left on the front side talking about your role in the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality and the assurance and role. Can you explain real quickly what that department's responsible for? I think some people don't totally understand.
Yeah, to summarize the scope of the agency, it's actually quite large. So the agency implements most of the federal and state environmental laws for air, water, and land.
And in those categories, where did you find the biggest challenge right now in Arizona, both from, well, you've got, obviously a lot of environmental activists, and you've also got very staunch, you know, free enterprise business thoughts out there. What was the biggest challenge you faced managing, like you said, over a thousand laws and a large workforce? What were the biggest challenges you faced in your time there?
Certainly. So as in most organizations, the biggest challenge for leadership is always harnessing the talent given the circumstances that you have. We were fortunate in that the Great Recession had just happened. So we did not reduce the force. The reduction in force happened as a function of the budget cuts necessitated by the Great Recession. And so there was a much smaller agency trying to figure out how it could achieve its mission. Most people join public service because they have a passion for the mission. And so do I. I have a passion for stewarding the environment. I think it's very, very important. And most people that were in the agency had that same passion and fire. However, as in most large organizations, over time, the bureaucracy, the inefficiency, tends to remove that thought that the individual can make a difference. And so the biggest challenge in leadership is always to connect the front line to the mission of the organization and eliminate as many obstacles as are in between. And lean management theory gives you a rich set of tools and principles from which to effectuate that. And so then what you do is you literally release in a structured and disciplined way the potential of the people that you have.
And you already said that you were very engaged in the environmental aspect of how things should be done to move our society and our culture and our country forward, and our state specifically in this role. By getting lean, you had the opportunity to instill that thought that we can make a difference in people who probably are working in that department because they too care about the decisions coming out of that department.
That's absolutely correct. Let me give you just one example. Our team that worked on state cleanup sites, so it's called the Water Quality Assurance Revolving Fund, right? So these are the nastiest groundwater sites and soil contaminated sites in the state. They're not federal Superfund sites, but they're state sites. They were under the impression, because of the bureaucracy, that they could only really effectuate work through contracting 9 months out of the year. And what happened was is that the catalyzing functions, things like IT, HR, procurement, contracting, right? All of those functions were not catalyzing, they were controlling. And so the people that actually add value, which are the frontline workers, needing to hire a contractor to go do some cleanup work, were under this mythology that they could only do work 9 months out of the year in order to keep the accounting straight. Once we learned that, we just eliminated that process. We figured out how to make the accounting straight on a fiscal year basis while still continuing work and not violating any of the procurement code. It wasn't that hard. But now, instead of working only 9 months out of the year on sites, employees were working 12 months out of the year on sites with their contractors. And so when employees started seeing that we were eliminating waste, that we weren't measuring and imposing a new system in order to have a hammer, but instead we were employing a discipline system with metrics and streamlining tools as a wrench to help us get more done, they ate it all up. Now, it took some communication, it took some building of trust, but once folks started to see what was available to them and what kind of difference they could make, they absolutely engaged.
And that's what you want, is you want both a team that's engaged in doing it, and you want people to feel good and positive about what they're accomplishing, because then they're more liable to put nice, hard effort into continuing to make things better. Now, there's going to be some folks that are going to go, ADEQ, okay, those are the folks that all the time tell us what we can't do. And then coming out of that job, you find yourself as the director of a school of mining. Why do you have that connection with the mining community, and what's your thoughts on the future of mining in Arizona? And we're just going to touch that before we go into a little more depth later.
Absolutely. So how does someone that has spent nearly 30 years working directly hands-on in the environmental field, including advocating for historic new water protection laws in the state of Arizona, how does that person end up being the director of the School of Mining and Mineral Resources?
Couldn't have said it better. What's the answer?
Right. So I have to give a little bit of background. So in my nearly three decades of environmental work, I noticed a few things. Some things became clear. Item number one, for the last 50 to 60 years, the environmental movement, which I was arguably a part of, had tried to wag their fingers at people and tell them how to behave and ask them to sacrifice and pay more in order to save the planet. And in effect, we've conducted a worldwide survey where we've asked people, are you willing to sacrifice, be inconvenienced, and pay more to save the planet? And the answer's been a resounding no. Now, some people get depressed by that, but what I did is I thought about, well, what does work? And Tesla is a great example, right? So the Toyota Prius is a great car. It brought electric vehicles to the marketplace in a way that had never done, that never happened before. But Tesla really revolutionized the electric car market. Why? Was it because it was the right thing to do in an environmentally friendly car? No. It was because that car is cool and full of technology. And so one of the things that we can see, if you really study environmental protection, some sacrifice is required, regulation is required, there's a place for those things, they are necessary. But when we couple them with innovation and end user facilitation, when we make environmental protection attractive, sexy, convenient, then we get much, much better outcomes. And so when we're talking about innovation and technology, then we are talking about minerals. In fact, there is very few, if any, definitions of technology that exclude minerals. If you think about it, even biotechnology requires minerals. There's always machines, there's always minerals involved. And so the way I see it, especially with the energy transition, is that mining and minerals are not the enemy of the planet. They're actually a catalyst to save the planet. All renewable energy is mineral intensive. All medical technology is mineral intensive. All consumer technology is mineral intensive. The population of our planet is growing. There is no future for this planet. There is no green future for this planet without abundant economic minerals.
And on that note, I'm going to cut to break a little early because I want to have plenty of time to talk about your vision of what the future inside our country looks like with regards to this energy. That's Misael Cabrera, the director of the University of Arizona School of Mining and Mineral Resources. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk, and we'll be right back. Welcome back for the last segment of Jump in Tucson, the engagement hour. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass. And tomorrow at 9 o'clock, you'll have Grant Kruger for Jump in Tucson. Not sure who he's going to have on, but I'm sure it will be somebody of incredible interest to you. So after Wake Up Tucson in the morning, stay on with Grant Kruger for Jump in Tucson. All right. I couldn't have said it any better. I loved how you closed that last segment with your thoughts. So knowing the importance of both the transition to green energy and the criticality of minerals, having been as the ADEQ director, what are the challenges that you see for Arizona, and what are your thoughts going forward?
I think that the first challenge is that we are no longer connected to the ingredients that give us modern life. I think that everyday folks don't really stop to think about how we have our wonderful and relatively abundant modern life. And if folks just stop to think about that a little bit, what they'll find is that there's 0 degrees of separation between life and minerals. Even our food requires minerals because you need equipment to harvest it. And so I think that's the first challenge, is that people really aren't connected to the fact that minerals are prescient in everything about modern life. The second challenge is that folks say, even if they arrive at, yes, minerals are necessary and mining is necessary, then they'll say, but I don't want it done here. Why can't we just do that elsewhere? And what most folks don't understand, and I have this understanding from personal experience working overseas while I was in the private sector, is that a lot of countries have environmental regulations, but few countries actually have environmental regulations and enforce them.
Amen. That is one of my talking points all the time, is there's no country that has the environmental regulations like ours.
And so what's occurring, and this is math that people aren't really connected to, is that when we offshore our mineral supply to countries that either don't have environmental regulations or have them but don't enforce them, we are literally increasing the amount of planetary pollution that we are fostering. Now, some people may say we need to invest in recycling and circularity, and I agree with that. We need to do that and invest in recycling and circularity as much as possible. But the math is in the growing population coupled with the growing wealth in the planet. So most folks forget that we're actually less poor as a planet than we were 40 years ago. That's driving demand in addition to the energy transition that exceeds, for some metals like copper, the demand that we're going to see in the next 30 years exceeds the total demand that we've had over the course of human history. We cannot recycle our way out of the problem. We will have to mine more. And when we don't do mining locally, domestically, where we have environmental regulations and we enforce them, all we're doing is increasing the amount of planetary pollution that we cause.
Well, that's a great point. I'd love to dive deeper on that. I'll probably have to bring you back for that one. So in your role as ADEQ, you see a lot of arguments about air permitting and water permitting. Well, you dealt with that directly.
Yes.
And now you've got two mines in southern Arizona that get a lot of attention. Copper World, Hud Bay, and you've got the Patagonia mine with South 32 out there. I'm going to assume, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you've got confidence in the process for those permits.
I do.
And you believe that when they're issued, the companies now, more so than maybe 30 years ago, are going to see through their promises.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about either one of those projects and where, how you see this playing out? And is there a difference between mining on private land versus public lands? And give our listeners just a little thought on that.
Certainly. So mining on public lands is much more difficult because then you have the NEPA process that engages. And one of the things that folks don't understand about the NEPA process is that it's actually not supposed to be a permitting process. It's not even supposed to be an approval process. What it is a process by which you articulate and account for the impacts. And if the impacts are unacceptable, then you mitigate. And so that process, because it is not as strictly defined, there's a lot of interpretation in that process, it can lead to lengthy time periods and lots of litigation. In terms of state permits, they're much more simpler. In state law, the permits are prescriptive and protective. And so what occurs in state law is that there are standards that are set. Those standards then are put into a particular permit. And then that permit is kept fresh through inspection and renewal. And so one of the things that I would like to tell the audience is that when we think about environmental impacts, we need to remember that risk is not a function of possibility. It's a function of probability. So possibility is binary. Can something happen? Yes or no. Probability tells you what the chances are. Now, if we did other normal things like driving based on possibility, right, we would quickly get to, is it possible for us to have a fatal car accident every time we drive? The answer to that is yes. And then none of us would drive. But that's not how insurance companies calculate your rates. What they do is they look at the probability of a fatal accident or things like that. And so environmental permits are set up to reduce the probability of contamination to a degree that's acceptable to society. And that's why it's implemented through laws and rules in a very public process.
And you've talked about, you always hear you either mine it or you grow it, but you've already established that if you're going to grow something, you have to have the minerals to do so. You've kind of said mining is the key to life. I think sometimes we in this country, because the availability we have and the access we have to these growing demanded items, cell phones, electric vehicles, all that, we lose perspective of where those minerals are coming from. And the bottom line is, what percentage of the minerals are we really getting from outside the United States, which puts us at risk both in it for our economy, but also for our national security?
In the most recent mineral commodity study by the USGS, they noted that out of 50 critical minerals in the study, we are 100% reliant on 12 of them and 50% reliant for another 29 or 30.
So when you say those critical minerals, the 50 of them, how many of them go into our everyday life, goods and services?
So minerals that are in everyday life are much more than 50. Those 50 are the ones that are subject to supply chain disruptions.
Thank you.
And so what occurs is that we are 100% foreign reliant on 12 of them, and there's another 30 or so where we're 50% reliant. And it is a very dangerous situation to be in. Any superficial review of history suggests that a lack of natural resources leads to geopolitical instability.
And in a lot of these cases, not all necessarily, but in a lot of these cases, we have access to some of those minerals here in the United States. It's just the lack of will to do the mining to get them.
That's correct. And again, we are happy to have an import-reliant mineral supply, and that is not good for the green transition. It is not good for security. Basically, our current practices have economic insult, environmental injury, and security concerns. And I would certainly like to see that turn around.
So we've got about a minute 45 left. Can you give me a minute on what are your goals and objectives, and what do you want to highlight about the School of Mining and Mineral Resources at the University of Arizona?
Absolutely. So as you stated earlier, mining is not new at the University of Arizona. It was one of the first two programs that the University of Arizona had when they first opened in 1885. And so mining has a long, robust history. What the school does is it takes into account that mining is a very multidisciplinary endeavor. So the mining industry needs environmental scientists, it needs environmental engineers, it needs geologists, mining engineers, business and procurement people, it needs HR people. And so what the School of Mining and Mineral Resources does is it connects the University of Arizona's entire campus to meet the challenges and needs of the mining industry so that we can have economic, abundant minerals for generations to come.
Ms. Ayala, I'm going to ask you to come back in the future, and I'm going to ask you to bring some of your other experts out to talk about the challenges we face. Thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Jump in Tucson. I'm Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass, and we will see you in a week.